Phil Benacasa, principal of the Olcott School, is being interviewed by Renee Garlick for an oral history for the Concord Public School System, with copies to the Concord Free Public Library. Phil Benacasa is retiring after 30 years with the Concord Public School System. The interview is taking place at the Olcott School on December 19, 2002. The year is 1973, and how did you come to Concord?
Well, it is, I think, the most magical, mysterious, almost religious way. I think my wife and I have always felt that our arrival in Concord was a blessing, and that we were being rewarded for some of the pain and discomfort and worry and difficult things we had experienced earlier, particularly when I began my principal's career in Prince George's County, Maryland in 1970. Prince George's County was and still is the largest school system to have ever gone through forced integration through busing, and I was invited to join their administrative staff at the age of 27. I was anxious to become a school principal, and we left home and hearth in New York in order to go there, and it was a real personal and cultural shock. I was named the principal of the Silver Hill Elementary School, very close by the Washington, D.C. line. It was a school that was not particularly rooted. We would turn over 66% of our students a year. Now, what that means is that two out of every three youngsters there in June hadn't been there in September. So it was nigh on impossible to build any sense of community. The racial makeup of the school was, in the first year, approximately 80% white, 20% African American. The system was under court order to desegregate. And in my second year, as a result of redistricting, it became apparent that the school, Silver Hill, was going to experience the same sort of racial change that the entire system would the following year. So I was called into the superintendent's office and asked if I would mind if the school and the experiences that the school went through during that year could be put under a microscope, and perhaps we could learn from that for complete implementation the following year. So in effect, the school became a pilot school for desegregation. It didn't take long for the word to get out that this was the school that was the pilot school for desegregation. And there were lots and lots of people who wanted it to be so painful and so disruptive that from a legal point of view, perhaps the courts would back off. And therefore the school became a lightning rod for all those social and political kinds of activities. And it was brutal. It was horrible for a 28-year-old to have to deal with that sort of thing. I remember having my life threatened. We got hate phone calls at home in the middle of the night, and we were cut off from family. We were very much on our own. We were ostracized by neighbors. My wife was pregnant with our third child. It was just incredibly uncomfortable. When we realized that we had simply had enough, I went to the superintendent of school, who was, it was easier to get an appointment with Ted Kennedy in Washington than it was with the superintendent. And I think it was a wonderful experience for me to have that kind of easy access. I really did have direct access into a huge bureaucratic operation. Anyway, I went and saw him and said, look, I'm through. I've done it. I'll hang around for implementation, but I'm out of here after that. And my family, my wife and the three kids, moved back to be near family in sort of upstate New York. I lived with a friend and would commute back and forth on the weekends in order to see everyone. But it was just a gut-wrenching experience. In any case, I remember saying to my wife on a weekend in, October, November, something like that, when we knew we only had one more year to go. And this was in New York, and I was going through the New York Times, and there's this advertisement for an elementary school principal in Concord, Massachusetts. And I remember,
which means peace.
That's right, yes. And I remember saying to Jackie, how would you like to live in Concord, Massachusetts? And I didn't know anything about Concord, other than the linkage of Lexington, Concord, and the historical kind of stuff, but didn't know anything about it. So I sent off a resume and heard nothing, just heard nothing. And in fact, it was further off in the back burner. And was considered for a number of positions in New York, which would have put us very close to family. But it wasn't sort of playing itself out. I got a phone call in New York on the weekend from a guy named Sel Whitaker, who said that he was the assistant superintendent in Concord. And then the light started going off in my head, and I started laughing. And I think I said to him, well, where the hell have you guys been? And he said, well, there's been some difficulties. And I knew immediately that something had to have been going on internally, which probably slowed up the process. And he said, would you mind if I flew down to Washington in order to visit you in the school? And I said, at that point in the ballgame, I had nothing to lose. I said, absolutely, come on down. And I will remember for the rest of my life sort of standing in the doorway of my office when this man mountain walked through the main door. Sel's about 6'6" and probably 250, 260.
I see a picture of him.
That's
right there.
That's right. Yeah. There the two of us. And I think we hit it off from the time we made eye contact. I was at that time 29. He was 30. And the assistant superintendent in Concord. We walked around the building. I shared some of the things that we had been through. We had lunch. He was impressed enough to invite me back to visit Concord. I flew into Logan on a rainy night. And Frank Curran, who was the director of transportation, was there in a school system station wagon, picked me up and drove me out to Concord. Now, it was a sort of a typical late April, early May, dark, gloomy, rainy night. I saw nothing. We came down Lexington Road. Even there, it was difficult to get a handle on what the place looked like. The first clue I had that this could be special was being dropped off at the Colonial Inn and told that I had the thorough room to sleep in. I had read Walden and been moved by it. And so I spent the night there waiting to be interviewed, really through the entire course of the coming day, by parents, school committee, superintendent, current principal, staff, things of that sort. But I remember waking up, kind of rapidly getting dressed, kind of breathing deep in order to get myself in the right frame of mind, and then walking out on the front porch of the Colonial Inn and looking out on a bright sunshine day over Monument Square.
Beautiful.
And I turned around, went back into the inn, picked up the phone, called Jackie. It was her birthday. And I said to her, this is it. This is it. And it seemed almost fate at that point. You go through an interviewing process and people are throwing hard balls at you. And I figured I batted at least 450. I was doing doggone well. And it went well. I don't want to overstate that. It's really interesting because it went very well with Ralph Sloan, who was the superintendent of schools, and himself only 29 years old. Obviously, Sel was in my camp. It went well with staff. It went well with the principal at that time, Marion Gorham, who, by the way, was just completing her 51st year of service in concert. But the school committee was a little hesitant. And so the vote from the school committee in favor was 3 yes, no no, 2 abstentions. That's not exactly a vote of confidence. Yeah? But that's the way it went. So anyway, I got a phone call from Ralph Sloan saying that the job was mine, and we were thrilled. And um, 24 hours later, I got a phone call from a superintendent of schools in the Hudson River Valley, which is what was one of our favorite places, offering me the job of principal of a special education school. And I said to him, you know, I just agreed to a job in Concord, Massachusetts. And he said, well, that's a pretty poor place, isn't it? I don't know. It didn't look that way to me, but what do I know? So anyway, I said no. I made a commitment, and that's where we came back. And we were invited down to sort of sign contracts and for Jackie to see the town and so on. And we wanted to look for a place to live. And this is 1973, and we walked into John Finnegan's real estate office,
Fred
D. Boyd, mm-hmm. and sat down with a very nice lady, told her what position I was being offered and that I wanted to live in Concord, and she opened up a huge book with a picture of the house. And she said, well, what are you looking for? And I said, well, we're looking for small, you know, old farmhouse, maybe 10 acres of land, and we'll pay as much as $40,000. And she took the book and just slammed it. Boom!
Not here.
And so she gave us a whole series of lists. And in that regard, we thought that that the second foot had fallen, you know, that we were teased to this wonderful place, but bam, here it was, we were going to be cut off from becoming a part of what appeared to be just the magnificent town. And it was very depressing. And I remember spending late into the night at the Arrowhead, then it was the Arrowhead Motel in Bedford, poring over these books, and Jackie was in tears, and, you know, what are we getting ourselves into, and all that sort of thing. And we went and looked at houses, and we went as far away as Stowe and all that sort of thing. And I didn't want that. I wanted to be a part of where I worked. And Stowe is no Concord, you know, and Lexington is no Concord. So, we're in the real estate, out of the real estate, in the real estate, out of the real estate, in the real estate. Finally, this little, clearly this little Irish fella walks into the doorway of his office and said, can I see you for a minute? And we said, sure, and we walked in and he said, my name is John Finnegan, and I'm the president of Prairie View Boys. And I don't like to interject myself into these sorts of situations, but I've seen what you're going through. He said, I wanted to show you something. And he went to the board and pointed to a house. So you see that house? That house in Concord? Buy that house right now. I know it'll be a stretch for you. It's going to be the best investment you've ever made in your life. I promise you. Well, we took him at his word. He was very cooperative in getting us hooked up with the Middlesex Bank so that we've got a very fair interest rate. There was some flexibility at that point in time. And we bought this house on Sawmill Road in Concord. We needed a second mortgage in order to carry it, however. And the builder, a guy named Dick Sunstein, said, well, I'll carry a second mortgage for $10,000. And we said, well, when will we sort of write the contract and all that stuff? And he said, no, that's all right. He said, I've done this lots of times before in Concord, and I've never gotten stiffed. People pay me back. And it really was an example of, you know, a handshake. That's what it was. And of course, it allowed us in. It became an absolutely wonderful neighborhood to raise kids. We had great neighbors, but it was very difficult to afford that big house. Now, John was absolutely right. The house probably went up 400% in about 12, 14 years, and made life a lot easier for us, and in fact, it made it possible, I think, for us to stay in town after retirement. One of the interesting things was during that period when we were searching for a house, Ralph Sloan, the superintendent, said to us, you know, there's a New England town meeting taking place tonight. Have you ever seen one? We said, no. He said, well, you know, he said, it's better than soap opera. You ought to go take a look. And so we wound our way to the armory,
yes,
where it was held that night. And we were in the visitor section on the stage. And here was this enormous group of people debating, arguing, being passionate about the whole range of events that the town was going to be dealing with in the coming year. There was no, with all of that passion and anger, anger is not the right word, passion and commitment, there didn't appear to be any hard feelings or it wasn't personal. And coming from New York, where A, you didn't know who was making the decisions in the first place, and B, if you didn't watch out, you were going to get, you'd end up with a knife between your shoulder blades. I mean, everybody was out for their own well-being, and frankly didn't care much about neighbors, cared about family, perhaps, but not neighbors, and would advance their cause at the expense of others, you know, and that just wasn't there, and that was just mind-blowing. In any case, I was offered the job as principal of the Ripley School. It was in architectural terms, a very progressive school. It was an open spaces school. It was said that it was an open spaces school because this was the wave of the future in terms of education, but I've always been under the impression that it was an open spaces school because that was the least expensive kind of school to build at the time. And given what we know today about learning styles and learning disabilities, it was really a nightmare. The assistant superintendent prior to Sel Whitaker's arrival on the scene, in part at the center of what Whitaker meant when he said, we've had some difficulties, was a very free thinker in educational terms. And he staffed the Ripley building, this new Ripley building, with graduates of non-teacher training institutes. All you need to do is a college degree. And the thinking was, I think, that if you simply put good kids with good people, they would learn. Whereas I had always felt that in order for people to learn, they had to be taught. I mean, there was a... And so it was necessary for me to sort of resolve all of those issues. They were volatile because it was real clear that Ralph wanted to change the direction of the system away from, pejoratively called touchy-feely, into a more instructional, academically centered kind of program. That was the late 60s, you know, and it was an odd time.
Were both Ralph and Sell new to the system?
I think Ralph, who was a protege of a guy named Mark Shedd. Mark Shedd was the superintendent of schools in Philadelphia. And Mark came from that superintendency to Philadelphia to teach at Harvard. And Ralph had done his internship with Mark. And I think that's the connection, and Mark lived in Concord. I think that was the connection that allowed Ralph to get a foot in the door. He was a baby. Like, the three of us were babies, which made it enormously fun and funny. They were funny people and loved practical jokes and were continually playing them. I mean, the school system was sort of like our big sandbox, and we could do what we wanted with it. And we were very full of ourselves and felt that we had all the answers and no one else knew what was going on. And it was just great fun. Philosophically, socially, we were all on the same page. I mean, our kids were growing up together. We were socializing. It was wonderful. Probably the best time of my life. But Ralph understood that the school system wanted to, in quotes, get back to basics. Let's start pushing on academics. And that really was the charge. And it became necessary to encourage a number of people who hadn't been trained as teachers, who were well-meaning, no question about it, good people, that perhaps this wasn't the profession for them. And that was that wasn't easy to do. You didn't want to hurt people's feelings. They weren't bad people. But you had, and you didn't want to fire them because that was ugly and inappropriate. But you did want to encourage. And so you had to be very, I felt that I had to be very careful about how all that played itself out. This, you did not come in here and roll over people. Again, the message from Ralph and Sal was dealt with people as real human beings and didn't play heavy-handed stuff. In any case, I think, you know, people got that message that the times had changed and this was not the right place. So we began to change staff and we began to focus far more on academics. And Dot Kress, who was a language arts specialist at Ripley at that time, was incredibly helpful to me. She was not a supporter of the... She had come on many years before. She was not a supporter of the direction the system was going and wanted to get back to, again, basics, and that sounds so trite, but it's true. You know, we want to teach kids to read. You've got to teach kids to read and write and do mathematics, or the community's not going to allow you to do other exciting things. Those things are bread and butter. We've got to get those things done. Ralph was also of the opinion, given his feel for the politics of the town, that the system did not want to be the best. We don't want to be the best. Fourth in the state, fifth in the state, salaries, test scores, that sort of stuff. But not number one. Because there was a sense on the part of a large portion of the community that we didn't want to draw attention to ourselves. We didn't want new people coming in. We didn't want to be another bedroom community of Boston. We didn't want to be a Western or Wilson. And that's absolutely in keeping with the whole history of the town. I always tell people, I've become sort of really passionate about the history of the town. But at the turn of the century in Concord, I think that if you were to say to somebody, we're going to the city, they thought you were going to Lowell. I mean, there's a real wall between Boston and Concord. It goes right back to the Revolution and all that sort of thing, first inland community. So we didn't want to, change was coming, and folks were anxious to keep it away from our borders. And the byword at that time catchphrase was maintain the character of the town. And that meant don't change. So I think we started moving in that direction. We started getting to be good but not great. Money flowed freely at that point in time. And life was good. The issues I had to struggle with were educational issues, not the social issues that I'd dealt with before, which were horrific. Kids were mischievous, but they didn't seem to present the range of neurological, social, and emotional problems that you find today. And that's just the truth. And so life was good. An interesting thing happened, terrible thing, tragedy. In some ways, from an educational point of view, Concord in the 70s was sort of the emperor's clothes. We were good, but we told ourselves that we were better. And everybody in town told everybody else that we were better. And there were enormous gaps and enormous shortcomings that nobody wanted to address. Best example of that was you had a high school that was built probably for 700 students with 1,600 students. And that was excused away with this concept of open campus. After all, they're only 2 or 3 or 4 years away from college when they'll be free to roam and wander. Why don't we begin to introduce them to that early on? So if they want to go to Friendly's and have a cup of coffee, let them do that. And, you know, why don't we take advantage of the surroundings? So why don't we offer gym classes at the Southbridge Boathouse? And we'll give kids instruction. If they want to go bowling, they'll go to the bowling alley, now CVS. And if they bowl a string of bowling, the owners of the bowling alley simply sent that up to the high school at the end of the week, and they got a check so the kids could bowl. And the real idea was to keep the kids the heck out of the building, because there wasn't room for them. And all that exploded when a group of young men from Boston, African-American kids, left the school, went to the Southbridge Boathouse. And unbeknownst to the owner of the Southbridge Boathouse, after a class had just gone downriver or upriver in canoes, they hopped in a canoe and went off after the group. The instructor told them to go back, that they weren't part of the class. They ignored him. And he went on with his class, and they went further on up the river. Somewhere around the Sudbury Road Bridge, one of them fell overboard and drowned. And from an educational point of view, it was a watershed experience.
It's around 1978.
The superintendent moved for the dismissal of that instructor, saying that he had not acted appropriately. He ought to have brought the entire group back and demanded that these non-participants get back to shore. The superintendent moved the school committee to dismiss him for cause. He got himself a very good lawyer, and in the auditorium of the Alcott School, over a 3-day period of time, from 8 o'clock in the morning, until on the last day, sunrise. In effect, the superintendent and our lawyer argued for dismissal. The teacher and lawyer argue that all of this was the fault of bad management of the high school. And the school committee sat as judge and jury. I supported the dismissal because it was not, and frankly, it was a continuation of a pattern of rather poor decision making. Sal Whitaker was opposed to it. I think Sal sensed that this was going to expose some warts in the system that were going to cause us all enormous pain and embarrassment.
So he and Ralph saw this differently.
Yeah, they did. Of course, Sal, being understanding the role of the assistant superintendent, got on board and didn't argue behind closed doors, argued against it, but not publicly. In any case, the school committee went into executive session and kept Ralph Sloan out, which frankly is illegal. The school committee cannot meet unless the chief operating officer is present. And Ralph knew he was in trouble at that moment. And the school committee came out and voted not. And there were some minor penalties. But I think Sloan understood his administration was over at that point. And following that, either in that June, I think it was that June, there was a legitimate race riot outside of the high school. And I knew at that time, and Sel knew, and Ralph knew that was it.
There was fighting. The Mecco students.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, it was. They were beating the dickens out of each other. Mecco threatened to fire Conk. They would pull all their kids out. And this was a terrible threat. In effect, they'd be labeling the entire town as racist. A good portion of the town was racist, no question about that.
But didn't realize they were.
Didn't realize they were. Absolutely not. That was an entirely different town. But there were strong feelings about those kids coming from that place, sitting in that corner of the cafeteria. Ralph handed in his resignation. Sal Whitaker was chosen as an interim superintendent. He had lots of discussion with me, and I'm sure his wife and others decided that he would announce immediately that he would not be a candidate for the position, which I really believe was in his best interest because he had lived, understanding the relationship between assistant superintendent and superintendent, he had lived in the shadow of Ralph for a number of years, and I thought he needed a fresh start somewhere else. But we had, as I view the history of the school system, you have these sort of huge chunks of time, the eras, where good things are done, good direction is established. And between them are these sort of short blips where the school system makes a mistake in hiring leadership. And so we had these, I would say, 7 or 8 years of Ralph Sloan and 1 year of Sal Whitaker. So this is a 9-year period of time. That's an enormous amount of time for a superintendency to go forward. And in large part, they mirrored each other in terms of direction. Sal left. A gentleman named
Leon
Pierce was hired, who, and this in some ways underscores the difficulty of working in Concord. He came from, he had a very successful record before his arrival here, and in fact, he had a very successful record after he left. But his tenure in Concord lasted only 18 months. It was a hard time, but he simply could not get his arms around the sort of unique quality of this town. Every town thinks they're unique. Concord, I assure you, is. At that point, 2.5 had just been passed. Enrollments were down. There was pressure from the feds for us to build more elderly housing in town, and they wanted the Bulkley building. There had been an addition to the high school, in large part, I think, motivated as a result of the death of that young man, the river. And so the Emerson Building was it was excess. We don't need it anymore. The system agreed to turn the Bulkley Building over to the Housing Authority, it and land, and they would then move into the Emerson Building. The Emerson Building may have sat empty for a year. I'm not real clear about that. And at the same time, the town wanted to dodge 2.5. They did not want to go to an override. It was the last thing in the world they wanted to do. And so they voted to close the Ripley School, which at that point probably had an enrollment of about 220 kids.
You're talking about 1981?
I'm talking about 1981. Now, I felt strongly that, I loved Ripley. I loved it. I loved the community I worked with. They were wonderful folks, and I was happy. Oh, I was at my happiest there. And I argued that it ought not to be Ripley, that it ought to be Willard. Well, so there was that old political hoopla. In any case, I think it's clearly because of the architecture of the building, which was kind of an embarrassment, and like a thumb hit with a hammer, you know. The vote was to close the Ripley School and to take the school population and to move it into Olcott, and then to redistrict Olcott to Thoreau and Willard. And that would sort of help. That would work. The school committee, in fact, ran out of the political energy to fight. They had the political energy to close the school. They did not have the political energy to go through the redistricting, which in some ways is more painful. And so I was asked if I became principal of the Olcott School with my community. In other words, if I came here with my community, could I fit both populations into the one building? And being youthful even then, and wanting to be a good soldier, I said, yeah, I think I can do that. And so it was at that point that we began to, quote, modify the building in order to enhance its capacity. Took advantage, converted a hallway into a faculty room, subdivided kindergarten rooms so we got an extra kindergarten room. Fed kids in the auditorium so that we got another classroom, and on and on and on, and we fit them in. And the promise was, Phil, look, the enrollment's going down, you can see it here, the trends, and within 2 years, you're not going to have anything to worry about. Well, the truth is, the enrollment did go down the first year, but it started to creep back up in the second, and in fact, grew beyond. And I was pulling my hair out trying to find space for not only the kids, but the mandated programs from the state that were new, particularly special education. How did you find that? And that put us in closets and on and on and on. At the same time, the building was used, relatively speaking, every night of the year during the winter for small committee meetings. It is the most heavily used public building in town. All summer long, it was used for recreation programs. You couldn't keep ahead in terms of maintenance. And it was aging at the same time. And the demands were increasing.
It had been built around 47?
No, 1950. Originally 50,
okay.
With an addition in 57.
Mm-hmm.
And it simply was getting to be an embarrassment. We ran, and I can say this now as I look at retirement, we ran a heck of a good program here. We had, I was blessed with a good staff that became a great staff, and today is, in my opinion, second to none. And we did well by kids. I ought to point out that after Leon Pierce was invited to leave, his assistant, a guy named Irwin Blummer, who came sort of from nowhere as a principal in Newton, he became the superintendent of schools. And he was the most focused, clear-thinking, ethical man I've ever met in my life. Now, we didn't agree on everything by any stretch of the imagination. But I never doubted his sincerity or his commitment to education and little or nothing else. His message was, we're going to be the best. I know where we're going. I'm going to take you there. And we are going to target being the best. Anything else is unacceptable. And he pushed us all clearly at the administrative level, we didn't necessarily like being pushed, but it did make us better. And we did become, I think, a lighthouse school system. Now, why did that happen? I think it happened in large part because of the embarrassment that had been caused around the tragedy on the river. And Irwin was given a lot of money and a lot of freedom and flexibility to do the job. And frankly, was very successful at it. And the town will always be in debt. We would not be the town today that we are if it hadn't been. He served, I believe, for about 9 years. Tom Scott, who had earlier on been the principal of the middle school, became his assistant superintendent. When Irwin left, Tom became the superintendent, and in large part built on the work that Irwin did. And I think Tom was here for 11 years as superintendent. So you have this now, you had this, as I said before, this large Sloan-Whitaker chunk of time, short Leon Pierce period of time, and now 20 years of the Blummer-Scott era. That's incredible stability for schools. And we were able to make, I think, real good progress. But all the time this was happening, new developments were being constructed. The average annual income of families was going up and up and up and up as the population changed. We were attracting people who were committed to education. And serving as owners or chief executive offices, or we were attracting a wealthier clientele. That, I think, led to some divisions in the town. I really do. I think it sort of exacerbated and angered lots of folks. You know, doggone it, I pay for schools and my kid can't even afford to move into town when he's got a good job. And so friction began, real friction began to bubble to the surface around what the system should be. Should it be good, as Ralph Sloan had hoped? Let's not draw any attention to ourselves. Or should it be absolutely the best, as Irwin Blummer had hoped? Those are two interesting positions. And as you can tell, they do lead to some conflict. Right across the boards, the neighbor against neighbor. I think Tom read this. I think he understood it. I think he understood that there were hard times were coming, and B, the town was divided. At the same time, I ran out of youthful joy and the energy and the space to make this sinking ship work any longer. I just couldn't do it. And I was invited to speak at the Colonial Inn on a morning breakfast for preschools and preschool supporters. And I remember Ruth Lauer, who was either a member of the school committee, I think she was a selectman at the time, sitting in the audience, as were other sort of local dignitaries and town leaders. And I began by saying, nobody moves to Concord because of its schools. And I remember Ruth's neck sort of snapping down. Move to Concord because of what goes on in its schools. Its schools are a disgrace. And then went on from there to highlight the shortcomings of not just the Alcott building, but other buildings as well. And frankly, that opened the floodgates. Because, again, that old emperor's clothes sort of thing. We had been telling ourselves everything was all right. It wasn't. And then the whole issue of the quality of instructional environment, whether or not the buildings in fact enhanced education or undermined education, all that became a public question. That led to the creation of the Master Plan Committee, which I was asked to chair. Didn't want to. I never liked chairing committees because I always thought it kind of shut me up. And I had to be more democratic than if I was just a member when I could yell and carry on.
About what year was
that?
That
would have been 1999, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we hired an architect, Cheap, who was asked to do a monstrous job And that is evaluate all of the school buildings in the K-8 system, not the high school, and make recommendations for changing them. The school system and the finance committee wanted an entire picture. and we came up, I think, with a brilliant plan. Unfortunately, some of the critical, garbage in, garbage out kind of thing, some of the critical pieces of information that the architectural firm had provided us with were inaccurate. Things like we knew we wanted elementary school classrooms of 1,100 square feet. The state minimum is 900. They calculated 900 square feet, not 1,100. They applied the same formula to the middle school, where we had much smaller houses, and lost six classrooms in that configuration. How that got by us, I'll never know. It is one of the great disappointments of my life, to tell you the truth. And we were told that we could do all four buildings for $55 million. The town said, go ahead. There was a rush, because we knew there were changes taking place at the state level in terms of reimbursement. We wanted to get in under the wire, because we would get 57% reimbursement. Every day, from that point on, it seemed to me, I got up and it was like trying to run through the surf. A new wave, a new pronouncements would come out of Boston, which knocked us over. You know, we would get up and fight past that in terms of the building project. And another wave, boom, would knock us over. We're thinking about reducing the amount of reimbursement. We want you to work on restoring as opposed to complete new buildings. We want to evaluate every building for its architectural value and protect those gems of design and rehab them, not rebuild. So this vote, go ahead and take a look at it. $10 million in that neighborhood. All the buildings were redesigned. A special committee, the townwide building committee of citizens, was created. They oversaw the entire thing, and the cost began to go up and up and up to roughly $75 to $77 million, as opposed to $55 million that was agreed by the town. And then there was an announcement that unless all of this was approved by a date certain, that the reimbursement rate was going to go from 57% to 37%. That's an enormous amount. And there's no question that we were rushed. At the same time, there was a philosophical debate about whether we needed two small middle schools or one large middle school. That debate had never been carried through to its conclusion. And the people in the Willard School neighborhood, I think, in a very unwise position, Willard being the newest of the three elementary schools and the one with a recent renovation, argued on the floor of town meeting that for only a couple more $1 million they could have a brand new school as opposed to a rehab school. It passed at town meeting by about, now it passed two-thirds, by about 60 votes.
So this was the 2000?
2000, I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I knew we were dead at that point in time. Mm-hmm. I knew we weren't going to make it at the voting booth. And in fact, it failed. Well, the end result of that was that we all stumbled around for a while. I was inflamed by that. I knew that the environment was below anything that was acceptable, and I simply wouldn't allow the town to forget the Olcott Schoolman, and did everything I could in terms of coffees and public meetings and
open houses,
visitations, videotapes, appearances before the school committee, appearances before the finance committee. To a certain degree, I'm proud of it, and I'm not saying it because of that. I simply said, I'm not going to let people forget this. This isn't going to go away. The Emperor's clothes era is over. And there were terrible things going on. Words were the three M's, mold, mildew, and maggots, all of which we had to wrestle with here because of the age and the construction of the school and forgotten vents that squirrels crawled into and died and on and on and on. And so we trimmed back the proposal to just be the Olcott School. And we went forward with that. That was under the regime of yet another superintendent of schools. When Tom Scott resigned, it was late in the ball game for hiring superintendents, so we went to an interim with a guy named Gene Thayer, who had for years been superintendent of schools in Lawrence and in Framingham. And he was a complete joy to work for.
It was the 98-99 school year.
I believe that's right. He was, if I respected Irwin Blummer because of his focus and his honesty, I respected Gene Thayer for his humanity. He was and is a magnificent human being.
We have him back.
We have him back. Gene was an interim, but not a I'm going to sit on my hands interim. He was very encouraging around the building project, but he was on loan. He was a rent a superintendent and an interim. And the school system went out looking for a new superintendent of schools and hired a fellow named Ed Mavridges. Again, Ed had a successful career prior to the arrival in Concord, but his three-year tenure in Concord was less than successful. And if anything, he personally, whether he earned the right or not, was a lightning rod for a lot of those differences of opinion about what the school system ought to do. I think Ed wisely read the tea leaves and threw in the towel after 3 years, but they were painful 3 years. They were disruptive 3 years. Once again, I would say Ed came from a successful career, and everything I know says that he's gone off to another one, which underscores the unique quality of Concord again. Once again, we bring back Gene Thayer, the systems whose humanity just spills out and has everybody sort of calmed and relaxed. And feeling good about the work that they do. We go ahead with the Olcott project. As much as I think the only reason people voted against it was because they saw genuinely as a threat in terms of their ability to pay taxes. You can't hold that against people. They weren't just being cranky, and they weren't just being misanthropes. They had some real fears, and we need to, you have to be sensitive to that. But there was not a single question that came up over that entire period of time, both through the master plan and then the single plan around the Olcott School, that we didn't have really good and solid answers for. And in the final analysis, I think people saw the wisdom of going forward with a new building. Unfortunately, we lost 20% reimbursement and had to deal with escalating costs over about a three-year period of time of construction. We have a fine new school on the board that's coming up out of the ground as we speak. This old building will serve, I hope, as a swing school for the Thoreau School, which absolutely needs to be replaced and as soon as possible. That alone will save the town $4 or $5 million in housing costs, because after all, how do you replace the Thurrock School unless you've got a spot to put the kids? If this building were to disappear, that would be a very costly addition. So I hope the town sees the wisdom of that. And we can operate two schools on one site for a year. We can do it. I know we can do it. My wife and I had always promised ourselves that I would hang up my sneakers at 60. If the master plan had gotten out of the starting gate and gotten traction and gone on to pass, I would have stayed until it was time to put the keys in the hands of new leadership. But the town, in its wisdom, chose not to do that. And so I'm leaving about a year before the building will be open and ready to accommodate new students. I don't feel badly about that. I'm deeply involved in the construction project now. We're obviously going ahead with the retirement. I have no second thoughts about it. Both she and I intend to stay in Concord just as long as we possibly can. And longer, perhaps.
Good. I just want to back up a little bit to how this project passed last year's, the 2002 town meeting, because I think initially the selectmen had proposed waiting.
Well, everybody was a little nervous, and everybody was prepared to wait. And I think that the individual who deserves enormous credit there is a gentleman named Ian Gillespie, who had served on the townwide building committee. He's a developer. And he understood the wisdom of this thing. And he understood his kids were out of the school. They weren't in the school. So he had no personal sort of investment. But he knew that the proposal for the new Alcott School was a rational, reasonable way to go. And he put his own article on the town warrant. And in effect, I think, painted the finance committee, the selectmen, and the school committee into a corner. And they were forced to what we would say fish or cut bait. Ultimately, they decided to get on board. And Ian was encouraged to withdraw his article, and the town went forward with its. And here we are, looking at a new building. But if it hadn't been for Ian Gillespie, I'm not sure that would have happened. That would have happened ultimately. But as sure as the Dickens wouldn't have happened anywhere near on my watch, it would have happened further on down the line. When we would have faced higher, it's clear right now, we're going to face far more difficult financial times at the state level in the future.
And less reimbursement.
And less reimbursement.
And so you got the 37%.
We got 37 plus. We'll work it because of added percentages for certain quality of work. Mm-hmm. For example, you present it, and I think this is wise, you present the state with a 5- and 10-year maintenance plan as to how you're going to maintain the building. They'll give you a couple of extra percentages for that. So we'll get it up to 50. Now, what's happening right now is they're saying, 37, for anything that comes down the path later, 37 is going to be it. So there's even more money that we've lost by waiting. And it puts the town in a very difficult position. Mm. You know, I've said for years, I mean, since the administration was in the Peter Bulkley building, I remember sitting in front of the school committee and saying, you know, we don't want Concord to be a school without, we don't want Concord to be a town without grandparents. We want folks to be able to live here. It's an important part of a community. And that's what happens in schools is schooling. What happens in a kid's world, what happens in a school is schooling. What happens in a community is education. Now that's paraphrasing Thoreau, but it's true. But it's the truth. We need a vibrant community. And it can't all be people between the ages of 35 and 55 who are millionaires. It's just not good. It's not healthy. So we've got to make accommodations along the way. But we cannot house our kids in buildings that are frankly decrepit. It's not in keeping with who we are, I think. And we need to keep faith with words are thorough in Emerson and Alcott. They ring as true today as they did then.
Do you want to say anything about the building committee?
Oh, I think the building committee is as good, if not better, than any building committee you can put together in this Commonwealth. And maybe these are good people. Mm-hmm. They're looking out for the well-being of the community. They're not going to allow the system to do this on the cheap. But they're not going to be extravagant either. And they've really found a fine middle ground. They challenge each other. They debate with each other. And what comes out of that, I think, is a product that we can all point to with pride when it's done and finished.
Do you want to mention their names?
Oh, Lord, there's a lot. There's too many of them. Jim Terry, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were three people who have been on this thing since the very inception. That's 1998. And they have worked day in and day out on it. You know, talk about civic responsibility. Jim Terry, who has been a selectman and is now working very hard on this.
He's the chair, right?
He's the chair. Fred Worsham, who was a parent here, was a member of the school committee, and now is on and has been on every one of the building committees right up to date. And Kitty Rockmill, who was a parent here, was a teacher here, served on the original master plan, and has served on the building committee, and now the Alcott building committee. It's a lot of time and energy. Those three people. Mm. There are others, obviously. But those three are the ones that I really tip my hat to. Because they... I learn every day from the citizens of this town how to become a better person. And they represent really, I think, the best of Concord. I just do.
So the total cost ultimately was...
Well, we had our proposal originally in the master plan was for the Alcott school was $14.5 million. That's up to $17.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
So the delay in quotes cost us $3 million, and the reimbursement is going to cost us minimally 9%, if not more. So you can do the math on that in terms of how much this is going to cost us. But it didn't have to. But it's the towns.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people have to say no before they say yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I love this town. I love it as genuinely as I love anything in the world. My wife says the town is my mistress. And I know I'm a better person for having spent the past 30 years here. Any strengths that I might have had, I've been enhanced by the town. Personal weaknesses, self-centeredness, egocentricity, all those things have been moderated by the town. So I am, and I think if folks go back to the beginning of the tape and think about the pain that we experienced early on in the career and where we are now, understand why you love town. I think both emotionally, constitutionally, my wife and I need a center that holds us. And that doesn't exist in every place. So we that's why we think we're blessed. That's why it underscored my belief in God.
It has a sense of community.
Oh,
there,
my
yeah.
goodness. I just can't. Who can relate to it? There are people. Not I can. I don't know how anybody relates to a shopping mall as the center of their life. I just don't understand it. I don't understand how people live in places where every fourth house is the same. As homogeneous as Concord is, if you look below the surface, there's a lot of differences here.
Yeah.
Some of it good, some of it not good. I don't necessarily go off on a tooth. But this division between Concord and West Concord, which I thought was humorous at the beginning, is a real tragedy. One prays that there might be yet another big dig and we could submerge Route 2 in the tunnel and kind of get past this historical and economic perceived difference. I think it's ill ill-founded and perhaps one of the biggest albatross around the neck.
Well, hopefully it's lessened, but there's something psychological when parents are bussing their children across rooftops.
Yes, well, that's true. And you know, and the image is somehow that the average income on the other side of Route 2 is somehow less than the average income in Concord. And I don't think that's true.
No, no.
But it's sort of this paradigm that people operate under. If anybody's ever seen the movie Being There, like Chauncey Gardner, I like to watch. It's sort of fun to sit back and watch Concord sort of evolve in front of our eyes.
Have the students, parents, how have they changed over
they
the 30
changed.
Years?
They have changed. And I would say, sadly, they haven't necessarily changed for the better. I think as people, they are good and decent and cooperative and well-meaning folks. The staff here at Olcott gets angry at me when I say the best thing about the school is the parents. I wouldn't be anywhere near as effective if it weren't for the fact that they demonstrated patience and insight and support and cooperation and respect. But, that said, something's going on with the youngster that comes to our door in kindergarten, as opposed to the youngster who came to our door 20 or 25 years ago. They are nowhere near as well prepared for the conventions of learning that kids were some time ago. And I think parents are confused about parenting. I think kids, therefore, are confused about their role as children. In 1975, if you took the chunk of time out of my week that I spent doing discipline, 80%, 90% of that would have been fourth and fifth grade level. And more often than not, that it was mischievous sorts of stuff. The kind of stuff that you could kind of chew out a kid for and send them out of the office and chuckle about what it was that they'd done. Today, 80 to 90% of my time in discipline is spent kindergarten, first and second grade. That's astonishing. And it's not mischief. There are really tragic number of kids with social and emotional baggage that they're having great difficulty casting off. And it's fallen to the school to help them cast it off. Now notice that when I say that the 90% is at kindergarten, first, second grade, by the time they get to fifth grade, things have generally straightened themselves out, but it's taken away from our ability to do early instruction, what we think we're here for, which is sort of that academic stuff. But kids are not coming to school. I think parents have bought into the business about, you know, the sooner my kid learns to read, the better they're going to be. Or if my kid learns to read at age 3, that's a direct line to Harvard. You know, that's absolute nonsense. There are so many more important things that need to be learned before they get to us.
To socialization skills.
To be, you know, is that business about everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten. That fella's got that poem out to clean up after myself and to share and to listen to others and wait my turn and not to cut ahead and all that's true. And generally speaking, kids had much of that in place before they arrived on the door. They don't have it. And I think it may be because of societal changes, an increase in the number of single-parent households, a number of households where both parents work either out of necessity or, truth be told, mom has been enormously, extremely well-educated and doesn't want to, is torn. I mean, I feel sorry for women in this day and age. Kind of torn between career and home. It's a terrible dilemma. And some people can do it. Some people can do it, and God bless them. But there are an awful lot who can't, and sort of err on the side of perhaps being overindulgent of kids. Whether that has its roots in guilt or what all, I don't know. But what I do know is that kids are not coming to school in kindergarten as well prepared to take advantage of what it is we're offering as they have been in the past. And what that means is that we've had to modify what it was that we were offering. And I'm at the same time, advances in medicine have allowed youngsters to arrive at our door who would not have made it through the pregnancy 20 years ago. Now, does that mean that I mean, it's a mistake? I don't know. It's not a mistake. What it means is that from a neurological point of view, that youngster may not come to school as well intact as kids 20 years ago, but that doesn't mean that they can't learn to be very successful. What it means is we need to learn how to instruct differently. And by the way, taxpayer, that means more sophisticated. It means smaller classes. It means special sorts of training. All of those kinds of things. Now, grandparent, if you want to toss away that little granddaughter of yours who was born at 7 months old, well, you wouldn't do that. I mean, you adore that kid. Okay, but the advances in medicine carry with them costs that show themselves in other places. Feel bad about that. It's just the reality. Perhaps that 7 month old has got the secret to the cure cancer in it, and we need to nourish all that. But it ain't like the old days, and it never was. I guess maybe that's the whole line. You know, there aren't jobs for people with just a high school diploma. You better get trained. Can't have 25 kids in a classroom. Not when you have kids in wheelchairs and all of that sort of thing, and specialists coming in on a regular basis. Can't do it. Kids are complex. We knew they were complex 40 years ago, but we ignored it. Correctly, we have both been encouraged and have chosen not to ignore it any longer. And that unique relationship between a teacher and a kid, there's no substitute for that. There's no substitute for it at all. And I'm constantly fighting a battle between those folks who push academics at the elementary school level and those folks who push experiences. I happen to come down on the experience side. I mean, God knows I want kids to learn how to read and write and all those kinds of things. But I doubt anybody who listens to this tape remembers exactly when they learned how to read. They do remember when Miss Brown took them to the top of the Prudential Building. Those are experiences that we need to be able to provide kids. Well, if we're choking on curriculum, then those options and opportunities go away. And I think that's real sad. We need to guard against that. And even in my absence, even when I leave here and take up my role as a citizen as opposed to a principal, I'm going to be watching very carefully and continue to argue in favor of the unique thing that happens when you put a particular teacher and a particular group of kids in a room for 9 months at a particular point in time. There's nothing else like it. And teachers ought to be free to take advantage of it, as opposed to worrying about whether kids are going to do a point better on the MCAS. That's what makes elementary school, from my point of view, the most wonderful educational environment in the world. I could have gone on to secondary school, I could have gone on to central office work, it was absolute nonsense. I have the greatest job in the world. Where else do you get paid to walk into a building and get hugged by first graders? Sometimes I feel guilty cashing my check. Not often, but sometimes.
Do you want to say anything about MCAS?
I am not a supporter of the MCAS test. I'm not a supporter of quick fixes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are schools and school systems, sadly, that don't have the resources to do the job. And I think the state ought to focus on those, not in a punitive way, not in a threatening way, but with resources. why spend, it must cost the state $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, maybe more, to monitor what's going on in the town of Concord. Now, it wouldn't take me more than 3 seconds to figure out a better way to spend that money in Lowell or Lawrence or Chelsea or Revere. You don't have to worry about what's happening. We live in a community that's not going to stand for a second-rate education and has the capacity to pay. So don't waste your tax dollars on Concord. Spend them where they're needed. And we've been too, educators are by and large peacemakers and don't want to get involved in controversy. Who is George Bush to tell us what approach we ought to use in teaching reading? Since when does phonics become a presidential question? That's none of his business. Or any of the other politicians who hop on that line. I'm not opposed to phonics, but I'm not going to be dictated to by somebody who hasn't been in a first grade classroom since he left. We know how to do this stuff, and we're good at it. And those other towns, those cities, Chelsea, Revere, Fall River, with the right resources, they can do it too. And so this is a waste of money. This money could be infinitely better spent on the place. Do the guidelines from the state as to what kids ought to be able to do, are they worthwhile? Yeah, they're worthwhile. Hard to argue with them. But let us figure out how to get there. Don't tell us how to get there. You know, here, I'll just give you a perfect example. Now, it's 10:15 on the 19th of December in 2002, and I know what our fifth grade scores were on the MCAS test. I'm promising you right now that they're going to go down next year. Because I know the cohort of kids who are going to be taking those tests. And you know what? I'm going to applaud them a year from now when they score lower. Because I know where they started, and I know where they've gotten to. And no MCAS test understands that. No MCAS test can rise up and say, good job, kids. They'll say, oh my goodness, you're down 2 points on him. Are you kidding me? Given what I know about this cohort of kids and the difficulties they have learning, we ought to rise up and give them all a big kiss on the forehead. I mean, they've done a great job. And the test doesn't have that built into it.
It's interesting. What are your plans?
My plans are to take about 6 months to a year and do nothing. I think I may have said earlier, I mean, I've had no second thoughts about retirement. I'm going to take 6 months to a year and just think, kind of clear my head. I'm going to say no to all of the, and they're already beginning to come in, offers of committee work here or committee work there. And then I think you'll see me back on the local scene in some capacity. I want to start giving back. And we, you know, really, barring some change in health, you can start to do stuff and not necessarily worry about keeping food on the table. And so I think philanthropic in the sense that there may be some skills that I can share that are going to be helpful, some insights that I might have after 4 years in this racket that might be helpful. I want to stay physical. This is a pretty cerebral job. I wouldn't mind at all spending an enormous amount of time around Habitat for Humanity. But I'm committed to doing the very best that I can do this thing. I would love this thing. I almost think that you got to come from someplace else to this town in order to appreciate it. If you're born here, it must be then, you know, it's a fish aware of the fact they live in the water. You got to come from someplace else. You got to really know in your gut what it's like in other places. And then you really appreciate it.
Well, this has been the Benicasa era.
Well, thank you very much.
And glad you came.
Thank you.
Thank you.